Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. Today, I'll be reading from the January-February issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. The first article is written by Sean Raviv, titled, The Ghost of My Lai. In the hamlet where U.S. troops killed hundreds of men, women, and children, survivors are ready to forgive the most infamous American soldier of the war. William Laws Calley, Jr. was never really meant to be an officer in the U.S. Army. After getting low grades and dropping out of Palm Beach Junior College, he tried to enlist in 1964, but was rejected because of a hearing defect. 2 years later, with the escalation in Vietnam, standards for enrollees changed, and Calley, a fairly typical American young man trying to figure out what to do with his life, was called up. Before the decade was over, Second Lieutenant Calley would become one of the most controversial figures in the country, if not the world. On March 16, 1968, during a roughly four-hour operation in the Vietnamese village of Son My, American soldiers killed approximately 504 civilians, including pregnant women and infants. They gang-raped women and burned a village to ashes. Calley, though a low-ranking officer in Charlie Company, stood out because of the sheer number of civilians he was accused of killing and ordering killed. The red-haired Miami native, known to friends as Rusty, became the face of the massacre, which was named after one of the sub-hamlets where the killings took place, My Lai 4. His story dominated headlines, along with the Apollo 12 moon landing and the trial of Charles Manson. His case became a kind of litmus test for American values, a question not only of who was to blame for My Lai, but how America should conduct war and what constitutes a war crime. Out of the roughly 200 soldiers who were dropped into the village that day, 24 were later charged with criminal offenses, and only one was convicted, Calley. He was set free after serving less than 4 years. Since that time, Calley has almost entirely avoided the press. Now 74 years old, he declined to be interviewed for this story. But I was able to piece together a picture of his life and legacy by reviewing court records and interviewing fellow soldiers and close friends. I traveled to Son My, where survivors are still waiting for him to come back and make amends. And I visited Columbus, Georgia, where Calley lived for nearly 30 years. I wanted to know whether Calley, a convicted mass murderer and one of the most notorious figures in 20th century history, had ever expressed true contrition or lived a normal life. The landscape surrounding Son My is still covered with rice paddies as it was 50 years ago. There are still water buffalo fertilizing the fields and chickens roaming. Most of the roads are still dirt. On a recent Wednesday afternoon, 10 young men were drinking beer and smoking cigarettes at the side of one of those roads. A karaoke machine was set up on a motorbike. There was a plaque nearby with an arrow pointing to a mass grave of 75 victims. Tran Nam was 6 years old when he heard gunshots from inside his mud and straw home in Son My. It was early morning, and he was having breakfast with his extended family, 14 people in all. The U.S. Army had come to the village a couple of times previously during the war. Nam's family thought it would be like before. They'd be gathered and interviewed and then let go. So the family kept on eating. Then a U.S. soldier stepped in, Nam told me, and he aimed into our meal and shot. People collapsed one by one. Nam saw the bullet-ridden bodies of his family falling. His grandfather, his parents, his older brother, his younger brother, his aunt and cousins. He ran into a dimly lit bedroom and hid under the bed. He heard more soldiers enter the house and then more gunshots. He stayed under the bed as long as he could, but that wasn't long enough because the Americans set the house on fire. When the heat grew unbearable, Nam ran out the door and hid in a ditch as his village burned. Of the 14 people at breakfast that morning, 13 were shot and 11 killed. Only Nam made it out physically unscathed. The six U.S. Army platoons that swept through Son My that day included 100 men from Charlie Company and 100 from Bravo Company. They killed some civilians straight off, shooting them point blank or tossing grenades into their homes. Here are the words of Vernado Simpson, a member of the 2nd Platoon who was interviewed for the book 4 Hours in My Lai. "I cut their throats, cut off their hands, cut out their tongue, their hair, and I scalped them. I did it. A lot of people were doing it, and I just followed. I lost all sense of direction." Simpson went on to commit suicide. Soldiers gathered together villagers along a trail going through the village and also along an irrigation ditch to the east. Callie and 21-year-old Private First Class Paul Medlow mowed the people down with M16s, burning through several clips in the process. The soldiers killed as many as 200 people in those two areas of Son Mi, including 79 children. Witnesses said Callie also shot a praying Buddhist monk and a young Vietnamese woman with her hands up. When he saw a 2-year-old boy who had crawled out of the ditch, Callie threw the child back in and shot him. Trung Thai Lee, then a rice farmer, told me she was hiding in her home with her 6-year-old son and 17-year-old daughter when the Americans found them and dragged them out. When the soldiers fired an M16 into their group, most died then and there. Lee fell on top of her son, and 2 bodies fell on top of her. Hours later, they emerged from the pile alive. "When I noticed that it was quiet, I pushed the dead bodies above me aside," she told me. "Blood was all over my head, my clothes." She dragged her son to the edge of a field and covered him with rice and cloth. "I told him not to cry or they would come to kill us." When I asked about her daughter, Lee, who had maintained her composure up until this point, covered her face with her hands and broke down in tears. She told me that Thu was killed along with the 104 people at the trail, but didn't die right away. When it was safe to move, Lee found Thu sitting and holding her grandmother, who was already dead. "Mom, I'm bleeding a lot," Lee remembers her daughter saying. "I have to leave you." Wen Hung Man, 13 at the time of the massacre, told me he went into an underground tunnel with his 5-year-old niece to hide, only to watch her get shot right in front of him. "I lay there, horrified," he said. "Blood from the nearby body splashed onto my body. People who were covered with a lot of blood and stayed still got the chance to survive, while kids did not. Many of them died as they cried for their parents in terror." Initially, the U.S. Army portrayed the massacre as a great victory over Viet Cong forces. And that story might never have been challenged had it not been for a helicopter gunner named Ronald Ridenour. He wasn't there himself, but a few weeks after the operation, his friends from Charlie Company told him about the mass killing of civilians. He did some investigating on his own and then waited until he finished his service. Just over a year after the massacre, Ridenour sent a letter to about 24 members of Congress, the Secretaries of State and Defense, the Secretary of the Army, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, telling them about the 2nd Lieutenant Callie who had machine-gunned groups of unarmed citizens. Ridenour's letter spurred the Inspector General of the Army, General William Enmark, to launch a fact-finding mission led by Colonel William Wilson. At a hotel in Indiana, Wilson spoke to Medlow, the soldier who with Callie had gunned down the rows of villagers. Medlow had been discharged from the Army because of a severe injury. Like many others who had been at Son Mi, he was essentially granted immunity when the investigation began. As he described what he had done and witnessed, he looked at the ceiling and wept. "We just started wiping out the whole village," he told Wilson. A subsequent inquiry by the Army's Criminal Investigation Command discovered that military photographer Ronald Aberle had taken photos during the operation. In a hotel room in Ohio, before a stunned investigator, Aberle projected on a hung-up bedsheet horrifying image of piled dead bodies and frightened Vietnamese villagers. Armed with Aberle's photos and 1,000 pages of testimony from 36 witnesses, the Army officially charged Callie with premeditated murder just one day before he was scheduled to be discharged. 18 months later, in March 1971, a court-martial with a jury of 6 fellow officers, including 5 who had served in Vietnam, found Callie guilty of murdering at least 22 civilians and sentenced him to life in prison. The day the verdict came down, Callie defended his actions in a statement to the court. "My troops were getting massacred and mauled by an enemy I couldn't see, I couldn't feel, and I couldn't touch. That nobody in the military system ever described them as anything other than communism. They didn't give it a race, they didn't give it a sex, they didn't give it an age. They never let me believe it was just a philosophy in a man's mind. That was my enemy out there." Despite the overwhelming evidence that Callie had personally killed numerous civilians, a survey found that nearly 4 out of 5 Americans disagreed with his guilty verdict. His name became a rallying cry on both the right and the left. Hawk said Callie had been simply doing his job. Dove said Callie had taken the fall for the generals and politicians who had dragged America into this disastrous and immoral conflict. In newspaper articles around the world, one word became entwined with Callie's name: scapegoat. Within 3 months of the verdict, the White House received more than 300,000 letters and telegrams, almost all in support of the convicted soldier. Callie himself received 10,000 letters and packages a day. His military defense counsel, Major Kenneth Raby, who spent 19 months working on the court-martial, told me Callie received so much mail that he had to be moved to a ground-floor apartment at Fort Benning, where the deliveries didn't have to be carried up the stairs. Some of Callie's supporters went to great lengths. 2 musicians from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, released a recording called "The Battle Hymn of Lieutenant Callie," which included the line, "There's no other way to wage a war." It sold more than 1 million copies. Digger O'Dell, a professional showman based in Columbus, Georgia, buried himself alive for 79 days in a used car lot. Passerby could drop a coin into the tube that led down to O'Dell's grave, with the proceeds going toward a fund for Callie. He later welded shut the doors of his car, refusing to come out until Callie was set free. Politicians, noting the anger of their constituents, made gestures of their own. Indiana Governor Edgar Whitcomb ordered the state's flags to fly at half-staff. Governor John Bell Williams of Mississippi said his state was about ready to secede from the Union over the Callie verdict. Governor Jimmy Carter, the future president, urged his fellow Georgians to honor the flag as Rusty had done. Local leaders across the country demanded that President Nixon pardon Callie. Nixon fell short of a pardon, but he ordered that Callie remain under house arrest in his apartment at Fort Benning, where he could play badminton in the backyard and hang out with his girlfriend. After a series of appeals, Callie's sentence was cut from life to 20 years, then in half to 10 years. He was set free on November 1974 after serving 3.5 years, most of it at his apartment. In the months after his release, Callie made a few public appearances and then moved a 20-minute drive down the road to Columbus, Georgia, where he disappeared into private life. Situated along the Chattahoochee River, Columbus is, first and foremost, a military town. Its residents' lives are linked to Fort Benning, which has served as the home of the U.S. Infantry School since 1918, and today supports more than 100,000 civilian and military personnel. The Army is just a part of day-to-day life here, the longtime Columbus journalist Richard Hyatt told me. And back in the day, William Callie was part of that life. Bob Podashev, the former mayor of Columbus, says there was controversy when Callie moved to town. "There were many of us who were just horrified," he told me, raising his voice until he was almost shouting. "It's just not done. You just don't go and kill unarmed civilians." Still, Callie became a familiar face around Columbus. In 1976, he married Penny Vick, whose family owned a jewelry store frequented by members of Columbus elite. One of their wedding guests was U.S. District Judge Robert Elliott, who had tried to get Callie's conviction overturned 2 years earlier. After the wedding, Callie began working at the jewelry shop. He took classes to improve his knowledge of gemstones and got trained to make appraisals to increase the store's business. In the 1980s, he applied for a real estate license and was initially denied because of his criminal record. He asked Reed Kennedy, the judge who had presided over his court-martial, if he'd write him a letter. He did so, and Callie got the license while continuing to work at the shop. It's funny, isn't it, that a man who breaks into your house and steals your TV will never get a license, but a man who's convicted of killing 22 people can get one? Kennedy told the Columbus Ledger-Inquirer in 1988. Al Fleming, a former local TV news anchor, described Callie as a soft-spoken man. When I met Fleming in Columbus over a steak dinner, one of the first things he told me was, "I am not going to say anything bad about Rusty Callie. He and I were the best of friends for a long time. We still are, as far as I'm concerned." Callie left town some years back and now lives in Gainesville, Florida. Fleming described how Callie used to sit with him at the restaurant he owned and talk late into the night about Vietnam. He told Fleming that Charlie Company had been sent to My Lai to scorch the earth, and that even years after his conviction, he still felt he had done what he had been ordered to do. After our dinner, Fleming gave me a tour in his tiny red Fiat, pausing to point out the house where Callie lived for nearly 30 years. He also pointed out an estate nearby that had been appeared in The Green Beret, a pro-war 1968 film starring John Wayne. The Army had participated heavily in the production, providing uniforms, helicopters, and other equipment. The battle scenes were filmed at Fort Benning, and a house in Columbus was used as a stand-in for the Viet Cong General's village. In the 1980s, the Green Beret house caught fire. When the neighborhood rushed out to form a bucket brigade, Callie was right there with everyone else, trying to put out the flames. During his time in Columbus, Callie mostly succeeded in keeping himself out of the national spotlight. Hyatt, the journalist, used to go to Vic Jewelers every few years on the anniversary of the massacre to try to get an interview with Callie, but was always politely denied. Callie and Penny had one son, William Laws Callie III, known as Laws, who went on to get a PhD in electrical engineering at Georgia Tech. But divorce documents I found at the Muskogee County's clerk's office present a dismal picture. According to a legal brief filed by Callie's attorney in 2008, he spent most of his adult years feeling powerless both at work and at home. It states that Callie did all the cooking and all the cleaning that wasn't done by the maid, and that he was their son's primary caretaker. The jewelry store, according to the document, was his life and, except for his son, was where he derived his self-worth. He even worked hard to try to infuse new ideas into the store to help it grow, all which were rejected by Mrs. Callie. In 2004, his wife, who inherited the store from her parents, stopped paying him a salary. He fell into a depression and moved to Atlanta to stay with Laws, living off his savings until it was gone. Callie and his son remain close. The divorce documents provided little information about Penny Vick's side of the story. In a strange twist, John Partine, the lawyer who represented Callie's wife in the divorce, was a former Army captain who had served as an assistant prosecutor in Callie's court-martial. "I'm proud of what we did," Partine told me, referring to the nearly 2 years he spent trying to put Callie in prison. He and his co-counsel called about 100 witnesses to testify against Callie. When Nixon intervened to keep Callie out of jail, Partine wrote a letter to the White House saying that the special treatment accorded a convicted murderer had defiled and degraded the military justice system. By the time the divorce was settled, according to court documents, Callie was suffering from prostate cancer, and his lawyer described his earning capacity as zero based upon his age and health. He asked Penny for a lump sum alimony of $200,000, half their home equity, half the individual retirement account in Penny's name, two baker's shelves, and a cracked porcelain bird that apparently held emotional significance. The closest Callie ever came to publicly apologizing for My Lai was at a 2009 meeting of the Kiwanis Club of Greater Columbus. Fleming set up the talk on a Wednesday afternoon. This is what Callie told the 50 or so Kiwanis members. "There is not a day that goes by that I do not feel remorse for what happened that day in My Lai. I feel remorse for the Vietnamese who were killed, for their families, for the American soldiers involved and their families. I am very sorry." The historian Howard Jones, author of My Lai, Vietnam 1968 and The Descent into Darkness, read Callie's words in news reports but didn't believe they showed true contrition. There just was no inner change of heart, Jones told me. I mean, it just wasn't there, no matter how people tried to paint it. Jones especially took issue with the fact that Callie insisted in the Kiwanis speech that he had only been following orders. It's still unclear exactly what Captain Ernest L. Medina told the men of Charlie Company the night before they were helicoptered into Sun Me. He did not respond to interview requests for this story. The captain reportedly told his soldiers that they were finally going to meet the Viet Cong's 48th Local Force Battalion, a well-armed division of at least 250 soldiers, which for months had tormented them. Medina later claimed that he had never told his men to kill innocent civilians. He testified at Callie's court-martial that Callie had hemmed and hawed before admitting to the extent of the slaughter. He said Callie said to him 2 days after the massacre, "I can still hear them screaming." Medina himself was charged, tried, and found innocent. I wanted to get firsthand reports from other Charlie Company men who were at Sun Me, so I started making calls and writing letters. I eventually reached 5 former soldiers willing to speak on the record. Dennis Bruning, a former private first class and second platoon who now lives in California, remembered Medina's pep talk this way. "We're going to get even with them for all the losses we've had. We're going in there. We're killing everything that's alive. We're throwing the bodies down the wells, we're burning the villages, and we're wiping them off the map." It would have been a compelling message for young men who had spent the previous months getting attacked by invisible forces. They had lost friends to booby traps and landmines and sniper fire. By March 16th, Charlie Company alone had suffered 28 casualties, 5 dead and many others permanently maimed, without once engaging directly in an enemy combatant. "Most of everything that was going on was insanity, in my view. It was trying to survive," said Lawrence LaCroix of Utah, who was only 18 when he went to Sun Me as a 2nd Platoon squad leader. "The problem is, when you step on a mine or a booby trap, there's nothing to take your anger out on. It's not like a firefight where you get to shoot back." John Small, 3rd Platoon squad leader now living in Washington, echoed these sentiments. "All your friends are getting killed and there's nobody to fight. So when we thought we had the chance to meet them head-on, we were pumped." Kenneth Hodges, former sergeant who is now living in rural Georgia, told me he was devastated when he heard of Callie's partial apology to the Columbus Kiwanis Club. "I felt like crying, really, because he had nothing to apologize for," said Hodges. "I know today I don't have anything to apologize for. I went to Vietnam, and I served 2 tours, and I served honorably. On that particular operation, I carried out the order as it was issued. A good soldier receives, obeys, and carries out the orders that he was issued, and he reports back. That is the way it was in 68. That's the way I was trained." In contrast, Medlow expressed intense remorse. He is living in Indiana, and he says that as he gets older, the memories of My Lai come back more frequently, not less. "When I am sleeping, I can actually see the faces, and that's the honest-to-God truth," he told me. "I can actually see the faces and the terror in all of those people's eyes. And I wake up, and I'm just shaking, and I can hardly cope with it. The nightmares and everything will never go away. I'm sure of that. But I have to live with it." Medlow stood 10 to 15 feet away from the group of villagers and went through at least 4 clips of 17 bullets each. He almost certainly killed relatives of the people I spoke with in Vietnam. It might have been Meadlow's bullets that struck Thong Thai Lee's daughter, or his Zippo that burned Tran Nam's home. The day after the massacre, Meadlow stepped on a landmine and his right foot was blown off. As he was whisked away on a helicopter, Meadlow reportedly shouted, "Why did you do it? This is God's punishment to me, Callie. But you'll get yours. God will punish you, Callie." Medlow was still angry at the U.S. government for sending him to Vietnam in the first place, but he says he no longer holds a grudge against Callie. "I think he believed that he was doing his duty and doing his job when he was over there." Tran Nam, the Sun Me villager who hid under the bed as a 6-year-old while his family fell around him, is now 56 years old. He works as a gardener at the Sun Me Vestige Site, a small museum dedicated to the memory of all those killed in 1968. The garden contains the brick bases of 18 out of the 247 homes that were otherwise destroyed that day. In front of each is a plaque with the name of the family that lived there, and a list of the members of that family who were killed. Inside the museum, items that once belonged to people of Sunmi sit in glass cases. The rosary beads and Buddhist prayer book, the round belly fish sauce pot, the iron sickle, the single slipper of a six-year-old boy, and the stone marbles of two young brothers. At the museum's entrance is a large black marble plaque that bears the names and ages of every person killed in Sunmi on March 16, 1968. The list includes 17 pregnant women and 210 children under the age of 13. Turn left, and there's a diorama of how the village looked before every dwelling was burned down. The walls are lined with Ronald Aberle's graphic photos, as well as pictures of Callie and the other soldiers known to have committed atrocities, including Meadlow and Hodges. American heroes are celebrated, like Ronald Ridenour, the ex-GI who first exposed the killings, and Hugh Thompson, a pilot, and Lawrence Colborne, a gunner, who saved 9 or 10 civilians the day of the massacre by airlifting them on their helicopter. There are also photos of former U.S. soldiers who have visited the museum, including a Vietnam veteran named Billy Kelly, who has 504 roses delivered to the museum on the anniversary of the massacre every year. Sometimes he brings them personally. The director of the museum, Pham Thanh Cong, is a survivor himself. He was just 11 years old when he and his family heard the Americans shooting and hid in a tunnel underneath their home. As the soldiers approached, Cong's mother told him and his four siblings to move deeper inside. A member of the U.S. Army then threw a grenade into the tunnel, killing everyone except Cong, who was injured by shrapnel and still bears a scar next to his left eye. When we sat down, Cong thanked me for coming to the museum, for sharing the pain of our people, he told me. He said it had been a complete surprise when the troops entered the village. No one fought back, he said. After 4 hours, they killed the entire village and withdrew, leaving our village full of blood and fire. Cong's full-time job is to make sure the massacre is not forgotten. For Americans, My Lai is supposed to be a never-again moment. In 1969, the anti-war movement turned one of Aberle's photographs of dead women and children into a poster, overlaid with the short, chilling quote, "End babies." It was largely because of My Lai that returning Vietnam veterans were widely described as baby killers. Even decades later, military personnel used the massacre as a cautionary tale, a reminder of what can happen when young soldiers unleash their rage on civilians. "No My Lais in this division, do you hear me?" Major General Ronald Griffith told his brigade commanders before entering battle in the Persian Gulf War. Yet Cong and the other survivors are painfully aware that all the soldiers involved in the massacre went free. The only one to be convicted was released after a brief and comfortable captivity. I asked Cong whether he would welcome a visit from Cali. "For Vietnamese people, when a person knows his sin, he or she must repent, pray, and acknowledge it in front of the spirits," Cong told me. "Then he will be forgiven and his mind will be relaxed." Indeed, the home of every survivor I interviewed had an altar in the living room where incense was burned and offerings were made to help the living venerate the dead family members. It seems unlikely that Callie will make that trip. Smithsonian offered him the opportunity to accompany me to Vietnam, and he declined. If Mr. Callie does not return to Vietnam to repent and apologize to the 504 spirits who were killed, Cong told me, he will always be haunted, constantly obsessed until he dies, and even when he dies, he won't be at peace. So I hope he will come to Vietnam. These 504 spirits will forgive his sins and his ignorant mind that caused their death. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the January and February edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. I'm Laura Bogart. So long until next time.